Today is Wednesday, February 15th. We're going to continue our work on the skin today. Why don't we do a quick review before we get into our new material today? From last class period, can you tell me the most superficial layer of your epidermis? Stratum corneum, good. Most superficial layer is stratum corneum, good. Can you tell me the deepest layer of your epidermis? Stratum basal, good. Now, if I were looking for stratum lucidum, I should look where? Palms and soles, good. Extra layer of thickness there, good. So, which layer of your skin, your epidermis to be specific, has dead, keratinized, dried out cells?
The top.
The stratum corneum has those dead, dried out cells. If I were looking for cells that were just now undergoing mitosis, where should I look? Stratum basal, good. Can you tell me the type of junction that helps to hold together adjacent skin cells?
The bonding, the dendrite.
You're close. Heard somebody say it? Desmosomes, good. Holds together those neighboring skin cells, good. And of course, when you lose skin, they come off together in sheets. So that's the whole point, is to keep those layers together in sheets. Can you tell me the type of pigment that makes your skin appear yellow? Good. It's keratin, right? Because what is keratin?
Water.
Waterproofing, yeah. So waterproofing protein is keratin, and a slightly different pronunciation, keratin, is that beta carotene, that yellowish-orange pigmentation. What pigmentation makes our skin have a black to brown appearance?
Melanin,
good. What blood pigment makes our skin appear red?
Hemoglobin,
good. And if we have very little oxygen being transported through our dermis, our skin appears what color?
Blue,
good. If we have a liver disorder, we expect to see what colored skin?
Jaundice
or yellow, good. Okay, and if somebody has, say, lots of sun exposure and little deposits of melanin all over their skin, that was called?
Freckles,
yeah, it's called freckles, good. Okay. So, any questions from last class period on Monday? So, we're going to go a layer deeper today. We're going to go into the dermis, and in your course pack, the dermis begins on page 55. So, in this picture, you'll notice that the epidermis at the top includes not only the stratum corneum, stratum basal, granulosum, spinosum, and basal, but then all this deeper stuff below is called the dermis, so it really is a thicker, deeper layer of the skin. We know the transition point between the epidermis and the dermis is groovy, and that helps to keep the two layers linked and locked together, because we don't want them to friction off past one another. So starting right below this groovy bottom stratum basal layer, we have actually two distinctive layers of the dermis. We have a papillary layer, and we have a much deeper reticular layer. I know it's really hard to tell in this picture, but there are, in fact, two different tissue types up here. I think it's easy to see what tissue makes up reticular layer. Can you tell me what type?
Dense irregular.
Good. So that's dense irregular connective tissue. Papillary layer is a little harder to tell. Oftentimes what we have there is loose areolar, but it's a very small layer right there up underneath your stratum basal, so it sometimes is hard to see that one. Once again, here is your epidermis. All of this stuff is epidermis. Keep in mind that your epidermis is no thicker than a piece of paper towel. That dermis is the deeper and thicker layer of your skin. Okay, so in the dermis, we expect to find blood vessels. We do expect to find nerve endings. So this is the layer that actually supplies your epidermis with its supply of blood. We expect for oxygen and nutrients to diffuse from your deeper dermis up through this epidermis layer. But you know, diffusion is only so good because you have a lot of layers here to work through, so we can't really reach these uppermost in the stratum corneum. That's why those cells tend to be dead, dried out, keratin-filled cells. Diffusion only carries nutrients and oxygen to these lowermost levels. So There is no direct blood supply in the epidermis. The way we get nutrients, blood, oxygen, all those other good things up here is simply by diffusion from your underlying dermis. I wanted to show you this picture because of dermal papillae. So what are dermal papillae? You notice they're labeled, right? Okay, this looks like hills and valleys. The dermal papillae are these little hills that poke up into the epidermis region. There's a valley, and then there's another dermal papillae. And you notice in this picture, that hill and valley effect actually translates all the way through to the surface of the skin. So those dermal papillae are the pegs that groove together with your epidermis and help to keep those two layers linked together. There are a couple of places on your body where you can actually see this hill and valley effect. Where can you see it? Good, hands and your feet, right. So fingerprints and footprint comes from this dermal papillae or this hill and valley effect. So interesting, all of your skin has dermal papillae. It's just only visible in those certain regions of your body. Okay, so what we actually see on the epidermis top side is called an epidermal ridge. Okay, and so that's what we call fingerprints and footprints, those ridges that we actually see translate through up to the topmost levels. Those are epidermal ridges. So we've talked about the sensory nerve fibers. We've talked about the blood supply that's here. That does make your dermis different from your epidermis. There is no direct blood vessel supply in your epidermis. The only way we get blood up there is through your dermal layer. What are the two layers of your dermis? Papillary and reticular, good. And the topmost or most superficial of those two? Papillary, good. And an easy way to remember that is those papillary layers create this hill and valley effect that we see with our fingerprints and footprints. So let's go back and take a look at our dermis. There's a lot of fibers down here. As a way of review, can you tell me the fibers we would expect to find in your papillary layer? Fibers are collagen, elastic, and one more.
Reticular.
Yeah, reticular. Good. So you actually have all three fiber types in that papillary layer. Don't let the name loose throw you off. It is, in fact, a very tough tissue type. And it's meant to anchor your epidermis that's groovy up top here in hot pink to the underlying reticular layer down below. Speaking of the reticular layer, it's made up of what type of connective tissue? Dense irregular, good. What fiber type is common in dense irregular?
Collagen,
good. And so what do you know about collagen fibers and their function? Strong, yeah. Are these elastic and stretchy fibers?
No.
Okay, so they're strong, they provide strength, a little flexibility, but their goal is to connect your papillary layer to the underlying tissue. And the underlying tissue may be something like fat or muscle tissue. So you get the idea here that you've got a loose, but a very strong layer of loose areolar. You've got dense irregular, meant to be also a very strong, tough layer. And this dermis is connecting your epidermis up top to the underlying tissue, whatever it may be. Okay, I want to show you some problems. If we grow too quickly, if we gain weight too quickly, pregnant women are often subject to this. These are striae or stretch marks. So this happens to be a tear in the dermis. And so what do you know about dense connective tissue and their healing rate?
Slow,
yeah. So if you're a pregnant lady and you're gaining a lot of weight and the weight comes quickly, then if we tear and stretch that dermis, that's unlikely to repair because this is torn basically in the dermis. It takes on a shiny appearance. All you can do is minimize the shininess of the stretch marks, but unfortunately that's not ever going away. That tear in the dermis is a permanent feature. So I know it's a sad thought to think about stretch marks being a permanent part of your body, but they're a tear in the dermis, and we know dermis is mostly dense irregular connective tissue. I know, it's like a lot of sadness there. These are blisters. Not everybody can actually tolerate henna pigments from a certain type of tattoo. Normally, henna pigments will stain your skin for about 2 to 4 weeks. That's about the length of time that it takes for old dead skin to be sloughed off and replaced by brand new skin from underneath. But in this case, these are blisters that occurred because of an allergic reaction. So when a blister occurs, what we actually have is water or fluid accumulating between two major layers. Where do you think this fluid accumulates? Between the epidermis and the dermis, yeah. So between those two groovy layers is where that fluid accumulates. Now, if you happen to get a water blister on your foot from having worn brand new shoes, that too accumulates fluid between the epidermis and the dermis. It's just a reminder that we really need to peg those two layers together, because if they were flat, they would just friction off and then slip and slide apart. So the pegging is what really helps to manipulate and keep those two layers glued together. The last thing on your page is really fascinating. These are called lines of cleavage. Not that cleavage, okay? These are different lines of cleavage. These are lines of collagen fibers that are deep in your dermis, and it's kind of like this deep road map on your skin. So which layer of your dermis, papillary layer or reticular layer, has lots of collagen fibers?
Reticular.
Yeah, reticular layer. So you'll notice that these lines are oriented around your body in certain patterns. These lines, are actually what we call the lines of cleavage. They're collagen fibers that run in different directions around your body. Now, if you're going to have surgery, you hope that your surgeon follows the lines of cleavage, meaning you cut along with the way the grain is going, so you cut along with that line. Why would you want to avoid cutting across the line of cleavage?
Scars and nerves,
and if you're trying to heal that and you've got collagen fibers running like this, they're not going to really meet up and provide the strength that they need in the underlying skin. So if you cut along the length of one of those collagen fibers, when that stuff heals, you have a better opportunity to heal that tissue. I think this is interesting. Take a look at the abdomen. A lot of women have C-sections. And look at the lines of cleavage. They actually run in a V shape down toward the crotch. So imagine if a female has a U-shaped cut through there. No wonder that has such trouble healing, because you're cutting totally against those lines of cleavage. Or even look here, if somebody's having knee surgery, see how those lines wrap around the knee like bands. So you can see why certain surgeries are really painful and perhaps longer to heal from, simply because of those lines.
Some of them actually
have surgery.
You'll have.
Yeah, tell the doctor, cut with my lines.
Right?
Yeah.
When they're doing like ACL and reconstructions and stuff like that with your ligaments, they have to cut vertical to do that. And when they do that, they tear those nerves up. You have numb spots the size of a softball on the side of your leg.
Which is awful, but there's nothing they can do, apparently. I mean, they've got to cut into it. Yep. Interesting stuff. Okay, how about questions on that page? By the way, if you would like to see your own lines of cleavage, if you look at your hand, look at your fingers, and it's not fingerprints, but there's these strands that run lengthwise in your fingers. Those are the lines of cleavage. And they'll probably run all the way up to your fingertip, but your fingertip has fingerprints covering it. But I'm looking down here in this first region, like right in here, and I see definite lines of cleavage. And I don't know about you, but do your fingers crack sometimes in the wintertime? They actually crack along the lines of cleavage. So you may notice if your fingers crack from the cold weather, they'll crack every winter in the same pattern, because they're actually cracking between the lines of cleavage. So it just happens that the epidermis is just thin enough there to help crack open the skin and, of course, see that dermal papillae from down below. All right, how about questions on 55? Hypodermis is on page 56. Where's the hypodermis located?
Under the dermis.
Under the dermis, good. Of course, hypo means below. Is it part of your skin?
No.
It is not. Okay? So poor hypodermis, it has no place. It's not technically part of any system. It's out there by itself, but it does connect your skin to underlying tissue. Most of the time, the underlying tissue is muscle, but it could be bone, it could be, say, cartilage, or it could even be other fat tissues. Most of what you find here is connective tissue. What specific type do you see in this picture? Yeah, loose adipose, good. How did you know? Little white spots, right? Yep, so those big white spots are full of adipose or fat tissue, triglycerides. Those are adipocyte cells. And of course, yeah, that's a great way to store extra fat and insulate around our bodies.
You said loose adipose.
Loose adipose, yeah. So if you're having a hypodermic injection, now we see where the injection goes. It actually goes into the layer below the dermis. So you would have to lift up the skin and then poke the needle into the area below the dermis. This area has a lot of blood vessels. It's got a great blood supply. And some injections are meant to join the blood supply in that hypodermic layer. You know, some injections are meant to be intramuscular, which means we would poke even deeper into the body. That muscular layer would sit beneath that hypodermis level. So if you're thinking about this, from the outside, we've got the epidermis, then the dermis. Now we encounter the hypodermis. And then if you were to continue down further deeper, that would now encounter muscle tissue or bone or even cartilage. So hypodermis is a greatly vascularized tissue. I want to make that point because, you know, liposuction is something that we can do nowadays to suck out excess fat tissue. If you had a morbidly obese patient, perhaps 800 pounds, why would liposuction not be the best solution? All the blood vessels, right. If you sucked out too much of the fat through liposuction and you broke the blood supply, that person could bleed out. So yeah, the blood supply there is really important. So what does this layer do for us?
Cushioning.
Yeah, it's protection, it's cushioning, it's where we store our excess fat. So if we want to estimate how much fat we're carrying, we can use calipers, which measure the amount of fat beneath our skin. So this is where most of us carry our excess fat. It's in this hypodermis region.
Say cushioning and storage of fat.
Yeah, storage of fat, yeah. Looks like we're ready for accessory structures. They're found on page 57. This picture shows us skin with hair. And just to put it in perspective, the epidermis is just this portion on the outside out here. That reminds us how very thin the epidermis is. And you know what? You can actually see the distinctive strata. This stuff on the very outermost layer, that is stratum corneum. The dark layer there is stratum granulosum. Underneath is spinosum, and the bottom layer is what? Basal, yeah. So almost all of this picture is dermis. The hypodermis is labeled down here at the very bottom, but I think this really puts in perspective how deep and thick that dermis layer actually is. I want to show you this one because you can see here comes the epidermis down into the dermis, and this forms a hair follicle. So in fact, a piece of your epidermis takes a dive and forms the hair follicles for us. In fact, some of them are actually quite deep, poking all the way down toward the hypodermis layer. So this really gives us an idea of how these accessory structures interplay with our epidermis and our dermis. So on the top of your page there, you'll notice that hair is located on all parts of your bodies except for palms, soles of the feet, lips, nipples, good.
Well, not all the time.
Well, the areola, the dark part, is actually supposed to be hair-free. I had somebody in class one time do this number. I was like, we're not having show and tell, but yeah. Palms, soles, lips, nipples, it's getting dirty, external genitals, okay? Palms, soles, lips, nipples, and external genitals. Okay, so in females, there are external genitalia called the labia, and there are certain labia that do not have hair.
So the epidermis in every hair follicle is going to dip like that.
That's right. That's
so
right.
It's almost like a pocket.
It is like a pocket. Yeah, you're right. And no wonder that hurts, because if you pull out a hair, look how deep it has embedded itself. These are also hair follicles, all of these. And you'll notice they're sitting down as far deep as the hypodermis. And below that, you've actually got some other kind of connective tissue. But it really kind of drives home how deeply embedded those hairs are. They're not meant to fall out because they're situated so deep and tightly into the lower parts of our skin. So let's talk about the hair structure. On your sheet, you've got the hair follicle first. The hair follicle is actually stratum what?
Basal.
It's stratum basal, right. So what do you know about the nature of stratum basal? What does it do for your skin? Good. That's cell reproduction. That's where new cells are made. So we know that for the epidermis, new cells are made by stratum basal. And for hair, that's where new hair comes from, is the hair follicle. The hair follicle is stratum basal. It gives rise to new hair roots.
That's what I was actually about to ask you. Is how when you pull it out by the root, it still manages to come back sometimes.
Exactly. Unless you damage that follicle, you're going to have hair growth return. I know some of you are sitting far back from this image, but what I would look for is something that's kind of a bluish purple color, and that would be your hair follicle that surrounds the entire hair, all the way down here to the root portion, which is the bulb-shaped ending. In this picture, this layer that comes all the way down and around that hair bulb going back up, that too is your stratum basal. So yeah, if you pull hairs out by the root, you have left the follicle intact, and the follicle can regrow new hairs starting with the root. So if you want to permanently damage hair growth and you want to completely end it in a certain region of your body, what part do you have to kill? The follicle, yeah. And that's actually stratum basal that you have to damage permanently. The only thing we have right now that can do that is electrolysis. So electrolysis would effectively kill that follicle. While we're here, this bulb-shaped ending has two names. Some people call it a hair root. Some people call it a hair bulb. But in terms of hair growth, this is where the hair growth actually begins, down here in this bulb or this root. And like we saw in the earlier picture, this may be as deeply embedded as your hypodermis, oftentimes as deeply embedded as your dermis.
So an answer to that on how the hair growth is affected, if it's damaged or falls off?
It's permanent, yeah, because if you damage that follicle, what happens to hair growth? It's permanently done. You're finished. And if the root is affected and the hair falls out, as long as you've got an intact follicle, it can grow back. So if the follicle is damaged, you're done. That is the end of hair growth. But if the root is damaged and the follicle is still intact, you can actually have hairs grow back. Okay, so if the follicle is damaged, the hair done is completely done. That's it. It falls out, you're finished. But if the root is damaged and you still have a functional follicle, you can still regrow hairs. So plucking hairs simply takes the root out of the follicle. It does leave the follicle intact, and so you would expect to have hair growth return if you were simply plucking hairs. If you were shaving hairs, all you'd be taking off is this portion that we can see above the top of the skin surface. What portion is that? The hair shaft, yeah. So hair shaft doesn't even bother the root or the follicle. All the hair shaft does is take off the dead keratinized cells on the outer surface. Okay, so the next blank there says made of keratin. The next blank is made of keratin. And what is the pigmentation due to?
Melanin.
Yeah. So the protein here is keratin. The color is melanin. Just as a side note, I thought I would mention this to you. Your hair will grow for several months at a time, and then it goes into a dormant period, and during the dormant period, it falls out. And so, you know, sometimes you may comb your hair and you say, good gosh, am I shedding like a dog? Mm-hmm. And all this hair is coming out. That means that a lot of your hair follicles probably are sitting in their dormant period, and you're literally shedding out those dormant hairs. Well, all your hair shouldn't be shedding at the same time. All of them are on a different cycle. So what we should see is that some are growing, some are dormant, some are falling out. So that way we maintain a pretty steady rate of hair growth. Now, the problem comes when you start shedding more hairs than you actually are replacing with new growth. Then what happens? Your hair thins, you can go bald, exactly. So if those follicles become more dormant than they are actively growing hairs, yeah, that's when we start to see thinning hair or baldness to occur. These are two different kinds of hairs, vellus hairs and terminal hairs. You'll notice a vellus hair looks fine, thin, and delicate. And these are the kinds of hairs all over your body except for those special places like palms, soles, lips, nipples, and external genitals. But these vellus hairs are the ones that you have on the inside of your arm. You may not think you've got hairs there, but if you look closely, this is like little fine peach fuzz hairs. Okay? These are also the little fine hairs that are on your forehead, on your eyelids, on your nose, on your neck. And at puberty, certain vellus hairs actually become stronger, more pigmented hairs that we call terminal hairs. So where would those become terminal hairs? Armpits, yeah. Eyebrows certainly thicken. Groin, okay. And then we, of course, have terminal hairs on our head. Head hairs are terminal. Eyebrows and eyelashes are terminal hairs. Terminal hairs are more pigmented. They're more of a solid, strong hair than those vellus hairs. Vellus hairs really don't have any pigmentation. I thought you'd be interested to hear a little bit about other hair stuff. Straight hair versus curly hair has to do with the shape of your hair follicle. If your hair follicle is round, it's going to produce a straight hair. If your hair follicle is more oval, when that hair grows out, it becomes curly. And throughout your lifetime, your hair follicles can also change shape. So you may start life with one type of hair and end life with another type of hair altogether. It all has to do with the shape of the hair follicle that the hair grows out of. Likewise, gray hairs, they say, are partially genetically controlled, and they say they're somewhat stress related. And so gray hairs are hairs that lack pigmentation, but it's more than that. Gray hairs also have little air pockets in them. So it's not just that they're lacking in pigmentation, they're more unruly because they have little air bubbles inside of them. You can't really see them in this picture, but that's what makes a gray hair a little more hard to tame than a regular pigmented hair. All right, how about hair questions? I started getting gray hair last year when I was 23. You know, my mom was all gray by the time she was 40. You know, so some people are unlucky in that way. You know, my dad's in his mid-80s, and he still has regularly pigmented hair. So some of us are lucky, some of us not, but it is mostly genetically regulated. Let's talk about fingernails. I think you'll be surprised how much a fingernail is like your hair. The same setup is here once again. So we've got roots and we've got follicles. Where does the actual growth have to come from? The follicle. Yeah, because if you kill the follicle, the root's just basically dead. Okay? So the follicle provides the growth for the root. The root provides the growth for the shaft. And so the shaft is what we see of our hair. And then in our fingernails, that's what we see on the surface of our skin. Fingernails are actually functional proteins. They're claws, more or less. And so they're not just meant to protect the ends of your fingers and toes. They're meant to be defensive structures. So in this picture here, you can actually see the nail follicle. This is, once again, stratum basal. There's that groovy edge to it, okay? And then this is the nail root right here. So you may have slammed your door, your finger in a car door at some point. You may know someone who has done that. If you damage the nail root and the nail falls off and you still have an intact follicle, can you get regrowth of the nail? Mm-hmm. Yep, sure can. But if you damage the nail follicle also, what happens? It won't grow back, yeah. So that follicle, just like a hair follicle, has to provide root growth. So it's dependent upon having that stratum basal still actively dividing. I had a student a few years ago. She said her grandmother had repetitive, horrible, ingrown toenails. And she said that her grandmother had all 5 toenails on both feet taken off. And she was much happier having no ingrown toenails. So, of course, they had to not only take off the nail itself, but they had to damage the follicle, because if otherwise, those nails would have grown right back. And I asked, did she paint her toenails or what used to be there? And she said, yep, she'd take nail polish and just paint the ends of her toes. And she was much happier being that way than to have those ingrown toenails grow back. I've also heard of people having damaged their nails, like maybe shutting a finger in a car door, and it displaces the follicle, and then you get a strange little piece of nail growing off to the side and the rest of the nail growing forward. So wherever you put that follicle, that's where the nail is going to grow. So weird stuff with nails and hairs.
But you know, some of the surgeons are actually unbelievably talented, because I had a 9-year-old who lost the tips of 2 of her fingers on a door at school.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, like, it was held on by skin. You could
wow.
see bone and the whole 9 yards when I got to the ER. And Dr. Mezzanotti is a trauma surgeon, and I don't know how he did it, but he reattached her tips, and her nails are growing now. They're rough.
Wow.
They're very kind of wavy-ish, but he said he thinks over the years that it'll kind of straighten itself out, but that was his concern. I remember him saying that he was worried about it damaging the actual base follicle of the nail, but he got blood supply to him. We were concerned about one finger. It didn't look like it was getting blood supply, but she keeps
that is
out.
Great.
But what's crazy is she can wear all the fingernail polish completely off of every fingernail on her hands, but these 2 nails hold fingernail polish. She can put them in her mouth, she can wash dishes, it doesn't matter, and the fingernail polish stays on these 2 nails until her mom takes.
That's interesting.
Which is very weird.
That is very weird. What's going on with those 2 that the other 2 don't have going on?
It's for whatever reason, I guess it bonds, but I mean, she's not any more careful with them than the other ones, but she cannot literally wear the nail polish off those 2 fingers.
Has feeling in those fingers and everything? Wow, that's impressive.
I mean, they were like from the base of the nail, I mean, they were hanging down.
Wow.
When I got to the hospital, so it was.
And that probably speaks to the plasticity of a 9-year-old's body that an adult doesn't have, too. So.
But he said if it happened to us, it would have been. We'd probably just taken them off.
Yeah. Wow, that makes you hurt.
Yeah.
But yeah, that speaks to the talent of knowing what to reconnect back to know, make sure that everything is still living tissue there. That's great. Let's talk glands. They're at the bottom of your page. These glands are mostly made up of simple cuboidal epithelium.
I have a
sure.
Structure.
Gotcha. Cuticle is that blank. Yeah, that nail bed is covered with a cuticle. So that blank there for the nail bed is cuticle, is that fold of skin that covers over. Let's talk about sweat glands for just a moment. At think you'll recognize some of these are really nice looking pictures of simple cuboidal epithelial tissue. These are exocrine glands. They're ones that open onto the surface of your body. In addition to sweat glands, we've also got oil glands in our skin that open to the external surface. And you've even got tear glands in your eyes, earwax glands in your ears, mammary glands. So there's a lot of glands that are exocrine in nature, meaning they open to the external surface of your body. So sweat glands come in two forms. No matter how you name them, they're sudoriferous in nature. Some of these sweat glands are what we call apocrine sweat glands. Some of these are what we call efferent sweat glands. So on your worksheet, the first one there says those glands open into hair follicles. What type is that? Apocrine or apocrine, good. So that first blank is apocrine or apocrine. I'll tell you an easy way to remember this. So these apocrine hair glands open into the hair follicles, especially in our armpits and groin regions. And they release a type of sweat that's not like the sweat elsewhere in your body. We think of this sweat as a more creamy type sweat. I know that's a disgusting thought, but it's more like a white secretion than it is a clear secretion. So this apocrine secretion is one that's associated with hair follicles. And I keep that straight because apes are hairy, and these particular glands open into the hair follicles of our bodies. Now that's different from the eccrine sweat glands that we've got. That second blank is for the term eccrine. And these are not associated with hairs. These eccrine sweat glands do produce a type of sweat that we're familiar with. This is the clear, salty sweat that we normally think of when someone says the word sweat. The job of sweat from an eccrine gland is to help cool your body down. That, however, is not the function of apocrine sweat.
Can you, you said that it's clear, salty sweat for
cooling us down.
Yeah. What about apocrine? What does it say?
Apocrine sweat is more like a milky substance. It's poorly understood. They think there's chemicals in there for identification, but not for cooling us down. So that's this kind of armpit sweat is not necessarily for cooling us off. It's more stress-triggered sweat. So apocrine sweat is poorly understood. We do know that apocrine sweat glands become active at puberty and that stress will trigger them to release this milky white type sweat. And it's not meant to be the kind of sweat that cools you down. So, you know, if you're really stressed out, you'll notice your armpits start pouring. So that is the apocrine sweat that's coming from those particular hair follicle associated glands. Eccrine sweat glands, though, are the ones that help to cool you down. That particular sweat is secreted when you're too hot, and the goal is to evaporate that sweat off your skin, which should help you be more cool. So it's the goal there is to reduce your body temperature. Sweat by itself has no odor, but it's the bacteria that live on your skin that reproduce and poop that leaves an odor behind. So it is the bacteria, in fact, that leave an odor associated with sweat, not the sweat itself. And yes, some people stink more than others. Some of us have different bacteria. It also depends on what you're eating.
So it's not weird to take a shower before you go to the gym.
Right. Because at least you preemptively strike against those bacteria, right? Because you're at least taking that one layer of bacteria off.
I didn't really stink when I sweat. I sweat like four. So
That's right, because you got rid of at least one layer of bacteria. That's good. Speaking of bacteria, they've actually done studies on people's hands, and they have found totally different bacterial population on each hand. So that just shows the variability on your own body, never mind from one of us to the next. So, yeah, those bacteria, they're the ones that make us smell funny, not the actual sweat.
That's got to be from our dominant hand touching door handles and shaking hands and all that stuff.
And wiping and all the other things that we do every day, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, you've got two other types of sweat glands there. Ceruminous, I can't ever get that word out. Ceruminous glands are earwax glands. Now, you won't forget that one. It's a funny-sounding name, right? Okay, so those are modified sweat glands that produce earwax in your ear canal. Likewise, mammary glands are actually modified sweat glands. So the milk production process comes from a type of sweat gland. Let's talk about oil glands for a minute. Sebaceous and oil mean the same thing. Oil glands produce a type of secretion called sebum. I've got you a blank there. Actually, two blanks. These are always associated with a hair. What is the function of oil? Why have it? Lubricate, good. What else? Protect and waterproof, good. Okay, so lubricate, protect and waterproof. And one more, prevent microbes from growing on your skin. Okay, one more there. Prevent microbes from growing on your skin. Lubricate, protect and waterproof, and prevent microbes from growing on your skin. So oil is actually an acidic secretion. Its job is to protect your skin from growing microbes. You know, I'm thinking back in time here. 50 years ago, people may have washed their hair every couple of days, maybe once a week. You know, nowadays people wash their hair as frequently as maybe once or even twice a day. Go back even further in time, maybe 150, 200 years. The norm back then was to wash your hair, what, maybe once a week, maybe once a month. So nowadays, you go into any store and you find an entire aisle full of lotions and creams and softeners and conditioners, right? So what are we doing with all that oil? We're washing it away. And what happens to your skin if you wash off all your oils?
Dry it out.
So then there we go back again with lotions and creams to put back on our skin. What happens to hair that's lost its oil? It breaks off, yeah. So brittle, dry hair is certainly not a good thing. And by frequently washing, then we remove and strip away those oils. So you can see as a society what we favor. We tend to favor being clean and not to smell over the fact of having moist, oily hair. So we obviously don't want to have moist, oily hair. We clean ourselves to remove and strip away that extra oil. But in fact, that oil is very important because it does help to lubricate, waterproof, and it does help to prevent bacterial infections on your hands. People who wash their hands frequently, bartenders, nurses, EMS, anybody who washes hands frequently removes and strips away the oils, right? Okay, so if you replace that with, say, some moisturizer, that can help. But people especially who are associating their hands with, say, I'm thinking here specifically bartenders, the sugars in the bar, the drinks that they're tending, that actually allows for fungi to grow into their skin. So a lot of times they get a fungal infection in their nails because they've dried out their skin, and those sugars in the alcohol actually give a great environment for fungus to grow. So, you know, there's certainly a caution about how frequently you wash your hands. So they say wash your hands, avoid disease. And then the flip side of the coin is you've washed away your oils. Okay, so can you tell me a difference between a sweat gland and an oil gland? It's triggered by stress or by heat. Good. Good. Sweat glands produce sweat. Sebaceous glands, what do they make? Good. Which one of these two types of glands is meant to lubricate and waterproof your hair and your skin? Sebaceous glands. Good. Which type is meant to cool you down? Sweat. Yes, the sweat's meant to cool you down. Which specific type of sweat gland may be associated with a hair? Apocrine, good. And what about sebaceous glands? Are they associated with hairs? Yep, good. So you see some similarities there, but you also see some big differences. Let's talk about acne for just a moment. So acne comes about oftentimes through follicles, specifically sebaceous gland ducts, that are contaminated with dirt, with melanin, and with inflamed oil. So the oil will actually have bacteria in it that inflames the ductwork or the lining of that hair and or the duct of the gland. And of course, that can cause a swelling around that area. Besides swelling, what are some of the other signs that this gland might be inflamed?
Red.
Hot and painful, yeah. It may in fact be itchy from the inflammation. So it's a lot of things to look for when you're thinking about the inflamed oil glands. So we are always tempted to pop these to get rid of the secretion, but we know there's bacteria in there, and that bacteria can cause infection if we happen to introduce it into a blood supply. So acne comes in two forms. There's whiteheads and blackheads. The difference is whether or not skin grows over the top of the inflamed gland. So this particular picture looks like skin is growing over the top, so that would be a whitehead. A blackhead is one that does not have skin growing over the top, and that means that the oil can hopefully escape onto the skin surface. The coloration actually comes from what's in that gland. Whiteheads oftentimes have pus, like you can see here, and blackheads have dirt and melanin down into that gland. So that's why it gives that particular inflamed gland a darker appearance than a whitehead would appear. So interesting stuff there. So a lot of times things like hormonal changes that come from puberty can cause this to happen, or perhaps changes in the skin, perhaps inflammation or autoimmune issues can cause this to occur too. All right, so that takes us to the bottom of page 57. How about questions so far? Is today's material making pretty good sense? A lot easier than tissues, isn't it? I left you a picture on page 59. It's already labeled, but you may want to look over it. A picture like that one will be on the test. So let's talk about hair functions. They're found on page 60. So when we're thinking about protecting our bodies from infection, our skin provides a first line of defense against infection. It is a protective barrier against microbes. Those are bacteria and small organisms that can live on your skin surface and can cause infection. So here's how we protect our bodies. We do have that acidic oil out there on the skin surface that provides a boundary or barrier against infection. What does keratin provide for us?
Waterproofing,
good. The simple fact that we have many layers in the epidermis to protect the underlying dermis, that in itself is a protective feature. And then finally, what do Langerhans cells do? They're leukocytes, good. And their job is to patrol and eat. Yes, so they're going to eat bacteria that make their way past that acid barrier provided by the oil. and by those many dead layers of skin cells on the outer surface. Let's talk about letter B there, synthesis of vitamin D. Fascinating link between your skin and your skeletal system. 15 to 30 minutes a day will give you adequate levels of vitamin D3. This particular chemical is carried to your liver and kidneys, where it's converted to an active hormone called calcitriol. You'll notice that calcitriol is important for bone metabolism. Specifically, it helps us deposit calcium and phosphorus to our bones. So let's say that you've got somebody who rarely spends time outside, who has very little exposure to the sunlight. What impact do you think that will have on their bone health? Brittle bones. Yeah, maybe not enough calcium deposited there, not enough phosphorus deposited there. So in addition to getting vitamin D3 through sunlight, how else can you get it? Yeah, dairy products like milk. Good. So if you're not getting any sun exposure, then of course milk products contain vitamin D3, and that should assist us with depositing calcium and phosphorus to our bones. So thank goodness for a backup plan, because you know, if you live in a cloudy environment and have very little sunlight exposure, then you certainly need a backup plan to get the vitamins in your body. Skin actually has a lot of receptors that tell us about the outside world. Let's talk about the tactile receptors. The one on the far left is going to detect fine touch rather, and pressure. So if you feel the vibrations coming through your skin, they're actually coming through these fine tactile or Meissner receptors. You may know that deaf people can feel the vibrations of music by using their hands to place them perhaps on a speaker. The vibrations travel from the speaker through these Meissner receptors in their skin, and then it can actually feel the beat of the music through those kinds of skin receptors. These are interesting. These lamellated receptors, they look like an orange or a lemon because they're a little bit elongated like a lemon. These are pressure receptors. So if you squeeze down on one of those lamellated receptors, then you have a sense of deep pressure within your skin. Probably one of the best examples I can give you is if you're trying to extract a splinter from your skin, or if you think back to the time that your teeth were being pulled, like if you yourself was pulling a loose tooth, the pull actually created a sense of deep pressure by compressing those lamellated receptors. The last kind here, these Ruffini corpuscles, these spread out like roots in your skin, and they detect stretching and tearing. And their physical appearance kind of gives you that idea. They're actually spread lengthwise along the surface of your skin, so any kind of distortion to your skin should alert you to the fact that your skin might be getting ready to tear or rip. Okay. Yeah. I may put one of the pictures on there and ask you to identify them, or I might ask you in general, what are the senses that our skin detects for us? And so, fine touch, pressure, vibrations, distortion, those are the kinds of things that we pick up on. But you have to be comfortable identifying those. Do you have any questions on those receptors? So here's just some views. You've got a Meissner corpuscle that detects fine touch, pressure, and vibrations. These are really cool looking. These are those lamellated corpuscles. What do they detect? Deep pressure, right? Like trying to extract a splinter or maybe pulling a tooth. Okay, and then switching gears completely, let's talk about letter D there, regulation of body temperature. So a major job of your skin is to help us regulate body temperature. You'll notice that normal body temperature is around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, and on the Celsius scale, it's around 37 degrees Celsius. So our skin is what we think of as a big portion of our thermoregulation device. Thermoregulation means what?
Control of temperature.
Control of temperature, exactly, good. So what we're gonna do here is break it down into what happens when we're too hot, versus what happens when we're too cold. The first thing I need to introduce, though, to you are some working vocabulary terms, vasodilation and vasoconstriction. The prefix vaso tells what?
Vessels,
good. To dilate a vessel, open it up, good. And to constrict a vessel, close it down, right? Make it shrink in size or narrow its opening. So vasodilation means we increase blood flow to a particular body region. Vasoconstriction means that we're going to decrease blood flow to a particular body region. So let's talk about what happens when we're too hot first. Oh, I've got cold. Let's do cold first. That way we'll stick with your course pack. If you're too cold, one of the things that's going to happen is your vessels are going to constrict. Now, are there vessels in your epidermis?
No.
No vessels in the epidermis. Are there vessels in your dermis? Yeah. So those vessels in your dermis will actually constrict. That limits the blood supply to the upper regions of your dermis. And that also limits the amount of heat traveling up through the layers of your dermis. What this means is the blood is going to travel deeper in your skin. It's going to stay closer to your vital organs, providing heat so those vital organs can continue to operate. Well, what happens to the color of your skin if you direct the blood supply away? Turns blue, yeah. So if you direct the blood supply away, your skin turns blue. In fact, that is a couple of lines down there. One of those questions, vasoconstriction reduces flow of blood.
Decreases is okay.
Decreases, sure. So reduces or decreases is good. And skin appears blue because lack of oxygen, exactly, good. So skin appears blue to the lack of oxygen. We're going back up. I'll hit those. I just started talking about this one since it's the picture. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Going back up to the first bullet point there, muscles do start to shiver. And, of course, the job or the goal here is to help increase the heat production. This is an involuntary function of skeletal muscle tissue. Likewise, erector pili muscles will stand hairs on end because that, too, helps us to trap heat around our bodies. Okay, so muscles begin to shiver to produce heat. And the last bullet point, erector pili muscles stand hairs on end, and that is to trap heat close to our bodies. Okay, so muscles start to shiver, and erector pili muscles trap heat close to our bodies. So you've probably seen a cat get freaked out, puff up his body, turn sideways and make himself look really big to you, and then walk sideways to you like, don't mess with me, I'm really big. You know, and it's supposed to be intimidating. Our bodies are really wired to work the same way. If you scare one of us, you know, you feel your hair stand on end, but nobody looks scary and intimidating when that happens because we can't even see your hair stand on end. The real function for it is when you're cold, because if those hairs stand up, that is meant to trap heat around your body and keep the heat close by. So that you can see because it produces what on your skin surface? Goosebumps, yeah. So if you see goosebumps, of course, that is associated with trapping heat and keeping those hairs standing upright or erect. So that kind of relates itself to the name of the muscle. The erector pili stands hairs erect or straight. Let's flip to the other end of the spectrum. If your body temperature exceeds 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, then we now have to release the heat to the environment. And what happens to the blood flow?
Increases,
good. So now we allow those vessels to dilate. Vasodilation allows more blood to flow toward your skin's surface. That loses heat to the environment. And then also what happens to your Ekman sweat glands? A sweat, yeah. So Ekron sweat glands activate, you lose sweat. Okay, so let's get those blinks there. First one, if you're too hot, Ekron sweat glands activate. Secondly, vasodilation increases flow of blood to your skin surface. And why do we appear red?
More blood flow.
Yeah, more blood flow, which has more oxygen. Who would like to tackle heat stroke?
That's your body's inability to get rid of the heat. Don't sweat.
You don't sweat, you can't get rid of the heat. Exactly. Those are the two factors there. You no longer sweat, and you can't get rid of the excess heat. Okay, so heat stroke means you no longer sweat, and you can't get rid of the excess heat. If your body temperature gets as high as 108, you can actually fry your proteins. And what I mean is you can denature them, and they no longer will take on their appropriate shape. So death can occur if you actually have a consistent temperature around 108. So unfortunately, with heat stroke, we've lost the ability to produce sweat. That means that we've probably dried out our bodies to the point of giving all the excess fluids we can to sweat that we can possibly donate. So in that case, we certainly need some fluids to help add back into the body. Do you guys have any questions on page 90? What is that? I can read today, 60. It looks like a 90 from where I'm standing. I would mark letter D as a potential essay question. I would mark letter D. So you guys already picked it out, right? Yeah, mark letter D as a potential essay question. I'll tell you something interesting about skin. It takes a year's time in a new environment to adjust to the new heat or cold that you live in. Any of you come down here from, say, up north? Okay, so your first summer here, how did you feel? Awful. Suffocating hot. Okay? I know we all think it's suffocating hot, right? So what happens is if you live in a cold environment, like, say, let's say you live in upper New York where it's, you know, extremely cold, where all the snow comes, your body actually puts your vessels deeper in the dermis. That way you don't lose a whole lot of heat. When you move down south, it takes at least a year's time to regrow new vessels higher up in the dermis. Why is that going to help you? Yeah, get that blood flowing, get the heat out of your body so it helps you to radiate heat easier. Likewise, for those of us who have lived in the South, if we decide to go live in the upper portions of the Northwest or the Northeast where it's, you know, perhaps colder than what we're used to, then now you've got a problem because you've got all these vessels in the upper dermis layers that must be moved down to the deeper dermis. So how might we feel going north for the winter? Freezing, yeah, because you're losing more heat than the person who's normally used to that environment. So there actually is a physiological change that must take place if you go and live in a brand new environment that has vastly different temperatures than what we're used to. Not much left in this chapter. Let's see what we can do with injury on page 61. We've actually been here already. We talked about it in general with all tissue types. This is particular to the skin. So we know that if we have injury to the epidermis and the dermis, we're going to start a repair process that first involves inflammation. Can you tell me the four cardinal signs of inflammation? Good. Red, hot, swollen, and painful. Good. So we expect to see that if we have injury to the skin. We know the next step is the migration of healing agents like macrophages and fibroblasts. Why are macrophages beneficial?
Bacteria.
Good. They eat the bad stuff, the bacteria. And then what do fibroblasts do for us?
Make new cells.
Make new cells. Good. So they're going to grow new fibers. Yeah. So the fibers grown here are typically collagen, which is strong and steel-like, not flexible necessarily like elastic, but they give a little bit of stretch to the skin, not a great deal of stretch. So I make that point because if you don't end up repairing this skin with normal tissue, you're left behind only with scar tissue, which is a little flexible but mostly strong, steel-like collagen fibers. As the wound heals, we see the proliferation of fibroblasts and we see the scab starting to shrink. Which region of your skin do you think is more likely to heal, epidermis or dermis? Actually, epidermis, yeah. Dense, regular connective tissue is very slow to heal, even though it has a blood supply. Yeah, but there's more growing factors, you might say, in that epidermis, like stratum basal, that can repair it if necessary. And then finally, once you get rid of the scab, we hope to have repaired this tissue with normal skin cells, epidermal cells and dermal cells, but it may take some time for the skin, or the scar tissue rather, to repair and be gone. If it's a severe cut, like perhaps through surgery, then we may be left only with scar tissue and that's it. So what does scar tissue lack that normal skin should have? It has more collagen and less glands and sebaceous glands and sensory perception, yeah. Very little oil in that area, so there's not going to be protection to the outermost portion of your skin. So we really don't want to have scar tissue left behind. It's not as stretchy as normal skin, and it certainly lacks what we needed to have. Nerves, blood vessels, glands, all that stuff that we expect to see in normal skin. So I'd like to talk to you about burns. I hate to get started and not be able to finish it. So why don't we make ourselves a note that we'll start here with burns and we'll do skin cancer on Monday. And then that will allow us to cover that in one sitting. Y'all have any questions for today? Y'all have a good weekend.